her being dosed with the potion, permanently falling in love with Waldo, betraying her vows, acquiring the pardon, running into Waldo again here. Surely all those things could not be random chance. Her God had to be orchestrating it. It had to be his will that Waldo be returned home to join the Order. She could accept no other possibility. The fact Waldo was a healer, and a potent one, she took as evidence of her God's intent. Those who had the talent in white magic were elites of the Order. Once Waldo was properly indoctrinated and enrolled, she had no doubt he would rise up the ranks. Instead of living a life of crime and debauchery, he could be an asset to the Order and the greater world in general. How could the one we follow not wish that? So long as Waldo became a true white mage and fulfilled his part in the God's plan, then everything she'd done up until now was justified. Her sins could all be forgiven, for all things were just if they were done in their Lord's name. She held on to the thought with an absolute iron grip. She was a servant of her God, working his will, helping to make the world a better place. When she delivered Waldo to Avalon, her God would surely be pleased. "Because if that's not the case," she thought, "I have betrayed everything I believe in for a man who is nothing but vile, awful, and I did it because of feelings I know aren't even real. I would be nothing but a sad, pathetic woman who was a slave to her own heart." She clamped shut her eyes and began praying again. She banished the thought and would not think about it again. She would save Waldo because it was what her God wanted. That was the truth, the only truth that mattered. As she prayed, she imagined kissing Waldo, loving him, hearing him confess his true feelings of love to her. She dreamed of being his wife and having his children.
"Silver, I think,"
the queen said, staring into the mirror and licking honey from her fingers.
"Make the tips like polished silver."
"Oh, tedious," Garibaldi thought. "Yes, Your Majesty." He held out his wand and adjusted the illusion. This was always the most boring part of his day, casting the illusion and adjusting it to match Mattis's whims. As if it really mattered, this ridiculous obsession she had with being young and beautiful. So long as the gold in her vault was real, every man in the world would want to marry her. Not that she had any interest in men. He didn't care about her preferences or tastes. Mortality was for the poor. What worried him, and the rest of the guild, was the lack of an heir. Mattis had a number of cousins and other relatives, but no designated successor. When she died, it would be a mess. A civil war might even break out.
"Everything would be easier if we could rule directly, without this nonsense."
In the East, there were some magocracies, lands where a single mage or a single family of mages ruled with absolute authority. There was Alteroth to the south, where the dark mages held power. If the guild could rule directly, Torakai would be much better served. Unfortunately, it wasn't a real possibility here. The local noble and merchant houses would never accept taking orders directly from the guild. They all insisted the head of state be from a royal bloodline. Most of the time it didn't really matter. The queen was lazy and disinterested in anything that happened beyond the court. She listened to his suggestions and things normally ran smoothly. But sometimes her simple mind would fixate on things, and she would dig in her heels. Her interest in Valeria and the ridiculous promises about Mithril were the worst example of that. The drow were horrifically dangerous and needed to be expelled. The white mages and their machinations were nearly as hazardous. It was no secret they were ruthless in getting what they wanted, but even he'd never imagined they would stoop to bringing in a seductress, or using a great monster or conspiring with the drow. The situation in the south had to be even worse than it seemed. Unlike the drow, the white mages could not simply be expelled. They had too much influence and support in the wider world. Nothing could be done that might give Avalon an excuse for open warfare. They had to be defeated with more subtle methods. Mattis stared into the mirror and gave a nod.
"Yes, I think that will do. So, what news do you have for me today?"
Garibaldi would get through the unimportant things first, so they could then focus on the serious matters.
"There was a bit of trouble in the outer city last night, Your Majesty."
The queen sighed.
"Not another baker killed?"
"No, not at this time. A squad of guards was sent out to arrest a family with an unpaid debt,
They were killed, all six of them.
Killed?
Mada said in confusion.
Yes, Majesty. Not only were they killed, but their bodies were mutilated and their weapons stolen.
Why would my people do that?
The Queen asked.
Don't they understand my guards serve me? That they are only doing their duty to me?
As to that, there are rumors of a new cult that is spreading quickly through the outer city, and gaining many followers. They worship some animal god or other, and seem very violent. I'm sure most of the people are loyal and love you deeply, Majesty.
Who are these terrible men?
The Queen asked.
And why would they kill my loyal servants?
Who knows, Your Majesty?
Garibaldi shrugged his shoulders.
There are always occults. The important thing is that they are the ones to blame.
What is to be done? I can't allow my brave guards to be murdered.
Of course not, Majesty. Commander Mueller has already had a couple of dozen suspects arrested. They will be tried and executed before lunch. Their heads will be put on pikes and left in the outer city as a reminder of what happens to people who flout the law.
That's good,
the Queen said, before stuffing another biscuit in her mouth. She inhaled it and continued.
I only want the guilty punished. I want the people to know that only criminals need to fear me.
Of course, Your Majesty, Garibaldi said with a stylish bow. The commander will be thorough in his investigation. No drop of innocent blood will be spilled.
The Queen nodded and licked the honey from her fingers.
As if we needed to waste the time, Garibaldi thought. We just need to make some examples and remind the rats we are the rat catchers.
Garibaldi knew thousands, probably tens of thousands, were going to starve to death this winter. In his opinion, that would be a good thing. Come spring, there would be fewer mouths and fewer troublemakers. Except for the young men who served in the fighting pits and the women who worked in the pleasure houses, he would be happy to be rid of the entire rat's nest.
What about this cult? Queen Mattis asked.
New things are always exciting, Majesty, Garibaldi reassured her. They are popular now, but before long the people will return to the gods of the realm. They will not trouble you long, Majesty.
Good,
she said, and had another biscuit. With the trivial matters out of the way, Garibaldi moved on to what was important.
Your Majesty, have you reconsidered my guild's request to disqualify Belle of Tarsus as a contestant in your tournament?
She frowned.
Why are you bringing this up again? I've already decided.
He smiled and spread his hands, trying to be as charming as he could.
Majesty, this is a most unusual situation. She is not simply another foreigner with dreams of fortune and glory. She is the servant of a white mage. She should never have been registered in the first place.
Perhaps, but she was.
Your Majesty,
contracts are sacred,
Mada spoke the old mantra.
The gods of the realm teach us that, and would be offended if I allowed you to break one. Besides, aren't you always telling me we can't break contracts? Not for any reason? That if we make one exception, we will have to make 1,000?
That is normally true, Majesty. There are always dukes, merchant princes, and rulers who believe that rules don't apply to them. They all assume that they can wager as much as they want and keep the winnings, but receive recompense should they lose. Or they have a wonderful time in their pleasure houses, only to regret the cost come the morning. Or they sign a poor contract and try to pretend they never marked down their signature. In those cases, we must force people to hold to their choices, or else agreements will mean nothing, and business will fall to pieces.
And how is this different?
Everything that touches Avalon is different. Nothing about them is ever what it seems. If a white mage says, good morning, to you, then you can be sure it is part of some deeper game. Everything they do has some hidden meaning to it.
Unless they just want to say good morning. Have you ever thought of that?
She always picks the worst times to think for herself. Just agree with me, idiot.
Majesty, you know what their goal is.
The events to the south must be worse than they let on. The barbarian woman entering the tournament at this moment is no coincidence. The white mages have always spoken against the games and called them murder. Yet now they want to participate. They have always demanded the drow be exterminated, or at the very least expelled.
Something you agree with?
Mattis wagged a finger at him.
We could replace you, he thought angrily. We could find some obedient peasant girl and give her this false image and your voice. We could have a real puppet who understands her place.
He and Lysman had considered it, but they'd rejected the idea. The queen had to deal with other royals and many of her own nobles. What if some of them noticed some odd behavior and suspected the truth? The risk was too great, at least so long as Mattis was pliable to most of their suggestions. If she caused too many problems, he and Lysna would have to revisit the idea.
True, he said, trying to sound patient. But hardly the point, Majesty. Despite all of their declarations and protests, some of them met and conspired with the Drow. Then, Valeria placed a massive bet on the barbarian. This is obviously all part of some scheme.
Hasn't Valeria placed bets before?
Yes, Majesty, she has. Though before this she always placed her bets on Varka, and none of those were nearly as large as this one. She is wagering a staggering amount, easily the largest bet ever placed in any gaming house.
You know the Drow don't value gold the way we do. Why does the amount matter? Aren't all bets the same?
The gaming houses of Torikai were famous for their willingness to accept any bet for any amount, and for always paying out to winners. We honor all bets was much more than a saying. It was a guarantee that wealthy gamblers from all over the Shattered Lands relied on. They could not be seen to refuse payment on a bet, which left the guild in a precarious situation. He gave his queen a little pout she usually found adorable.
The Drow leader placing the largest bet in history on a contestant who works for a white mage, whose order has always condemned the games. Your Majesty, if that is not an exception, I can't imagine what is.
Mattis took another biscuit and looked at her image in the mirror.
All contracts are sacred. What else?
Garibaldi wanted to continue the discussion, but knew better. Mattis had made up her mind, and did not take well to being corrected or told she was wrong. The guild would need to figure something else out.
King Dubois wishes to offer you a special gift prior to your birthday. He was hoping for a private audience where he could...
Keep your guard up!
Restus yelled, and slapped the wooden practice sword aside with his own.
How do you expect to survive even one match?
I'll bash their heads in with my fist, Bell said truthfully. You don't need to be so mean about it.
Your master gave me 11 silver coins to give you as much training as I can. I'm a man of my word, and so I'll do what I can, even if it is a waste. Now get in a fighting stance.
Bell sighed. At the very start this had been sort of fun, learning to swing a sword like a real barbarian. But it had stopped being entertaining a while ago. All Restus did was yell a lot, and make her do the same thing over and over and over. It was boring and no fun.
But it's what Master wants.
With a sigh, Belle spread her feet apart, turned sideways toward Restus, and held the wooden sword out in front of her at shoulder height. Or at least at the shoulder height of the illusion. In reality, it was closer to navel than shoulder. Restus lunged forward with a thrust. Bell swung her sword to block, but the thrust got through, and landed on what looked like Bell's shoulder.
"Too slow, too weak, and too damn clumsy," Restus declared. "I've met half-trained novices with missing fingers who are more agile than you."
"Don't you ever say anything nice. I might do better if you were encouraging."
Restus shook his head.
"I don't understand why the white mage is throwing his silver away on these lessons. I mean, you do understand that your master is sending you to die, don't you? Except for you, every single contestant in that tournament is a real fighter. It won't be like the matches in the fighting pits. There won't be any half-trained amateurs there just to be slaughtered."
"It's fine," Bell said cheerfully. "Master just wants me to know the basics and not embarrass myself."
"It will be worse than embarrassing when someone puts a sword through you."
Bell grinned. Ogres were very hard to kill. Ordinary steel wouldn't even scratch an ogre's hide. The Minotaur might be dangerous, but there wasn't much need to worry about anyone else. A young woman strolled into the gymnasium. She was short and would likely have only come up to her master's chin. Her arms and legs were well-muscled. She had tanned skin and sandy hair that fell to her shoulders. The woman wore a plain leather jerkin, a skirt made of strips of boiled leather, and knee-high boots. Belted on her hip was a curved sword and a pair of long daggers.
"Excuse me," the woman called out. "I'd like to do a little bit of training."
Restus looked her over.
"I hadn't got any women here in a long while. Now I've got two in as many days. You fighting in the Queen's tournament?
I'm not signed up for it, but if things look interesting, maybe I'll sneak in.
That's good, Resta said. If you want to fight for money, you're better off in the fighting pits in the arena.
I know. I fought in the pits. The woman had both hands behind her back and was looking Bell over.
You have? Resta sounded surprised. I haven't heard of any women fighting in them.
She smiled. So, can I train here? Besides Bell, there were 6 men spread out practicing with one another. Restus nodded.
It's 20 copper marks per day, payable up front. I can't offer any training until after the tournament.
He motioned to Bell.
I've been hired and have more work to do than I can handle.
Okay, you're being a meanie again, Bell complained.
She reached into her belt and tossed a silver coin to Restus, who snatched it out of the air.
I'll pay for 5, just in case. Do you think I could spar with her, just to warm up?
Restus glanced at Bell.
Do you mind? It might do you some good to work with someone else.
Bell shrugged. Fine by me. Restus spoke to the new arrival.
What's your name?
You can call me Nen.
Just Nen? She thought for a moment.
You can call me Nen of Far, Far Away, if you prefer.
Restus motioned to the wall behind him. There was a rack filled with wooden swords and quarterstaffs.
Grab a practice sword. This is just training, and your partner's a novice. Try not to hurt her.
Nen picked out a wooden blade and came over to stand across from Bell.
I promise to be gentle.
As Bell got into a fighting stance, she got a good whiff of Nen's scent. Bell's eyes widened.
I know who you are. That's nice, Nen said. I know who I am, too.
She dashed forward, as Bell was just holding her sword out. She swung with all her might and smashed her wooden sword into the middle of Bell's face. Had Bell been what she seemed, her nose would have been flattened, and she'd be on her back. In reality, Nen had instead hit the ogre in the chest just below the throat.
Stop! Restus shouted. This is just practice! You could have seriously hurt or even killed her!
Nen had danced back to her starting point before Bell could even move her feet.
I'm sure she's fine. I have a feeling this wooden stick can't hurt anything but her pride. Isn't that right, my pretty?
Bell frowned and rubbed the spot where she'd been hit.
I thought you said you'd be gentle. I was.
Nen grinned and swung her wooden blade through the air 3 times in the span of a heartbeat.
If I decide to be rough with you, you'll know it. You're kind of small to be making threats.
She took hold of her practice sword with both hands and lifted it above her head. She dashed forward 2 steps and brought it down with all her strength on Bell's wrist. The thwack was loud enough to echo through the building.
Ow!
Bell dropped her wooden sword and shook her hand. Nen took another step and pressed the tip of her sword to the illusory side of Bell's neck.
Being big just makes you more of a target sometimes.
What do you think you're doing?
Restus yelled. He ran forward and grabbed Nen's sword.
You could break her arm!
When Restus wrenched the wooden sword away, Nen made no effort to hold onto it. She danced back a few steps as Bell rubbed her wrist and glared at her.
Sorry, got a little carried away there.
Are you all right, pretty girl?
I'm fine,
Bell muttered, and picked her own wooden blade back up.
You know, anyone would think that a fighter serving a white mage and carrying a magical sword would be very skilled. Especially if they knew about your hidden strength.
Nen said with a wide smile.
I thought that myself, but I can see it's not so. You can't use that sword at all, can you? You've always just relied on your strength and that thick hide of yours to see you safely through. Well, that'll probably be enough to get you to the finals, but Varka will turn you into dog meat.
I can handle Varka even without a sword, Bell said.
No, you can't, Resta said. She's giving you too much credit thinking you'll even make it that far.
Why are you taking her side?
Bell asked, sounding hurt.
I'm not. I told you from the start you've got no hope.
Restus turned to Nen.
You obviously don't need any training. If all you want is to practice and warm up, why don't you wail away on one of the straw bags?
That's all right. I think I've had enough.
Nen began walking towards the door.
That's it?
Restus asked.
You paid a silver mark. You sure you don't want to do anything more?
Not today, though I may drop by again. I've seen what I needed to.
She gave Bell a cheerful wave and left.
Bitch,
Bell muttered beneath her breath. Waldo had escaped from the palace before Melissa could come grab him. His first stop was to the local herbal shop. He'd been delighted to discover it was a proper herbal shop with mandrake, devil grass, lotus blossoms, and all the other essentials for brewing potions. Knowing how rare they were now, he'd made sure to stock up. He'd been slightly disappointed to discover there were no high-end special ingredients, such as ground unicorn horn, kraken ink, or dragon scales. In Alteroth, such precious items were not always available, but they did pop up from time to time. When Waldo had asked the proprietor, he'd stared back and wanted to know if Waldo was serious. Mage guilds were very rare, and the one here in Torukai was among the best known in the world. If the shop supplying them didn't carry any special ingredients, he doubted he would find them anywhere outside of Alter. With different pockets bulging with the components they did have, Waldo set out for the Great Market. He didn't have any specific need, but he could look around and see if there was anything that might be useful. Maybe he would buy Alice a silk scarf or something. Lately she'd been in a bad mood despite getting to spend all her time playing with the queen and her maids. Women were hard to please. As Waldo was heading towards the market, he sensed a mage approaching him.
"Good morning, Master Rabbit."
"Master Lysnum?
I was wondering if you could come to the guild hall with me. There's something I'd like to discuss with you."
Waldo frowned. "This isn't about Belle, is it?"
"It's about a rare opportunity. Perhaps it will not take long and could be incredibly rewarding for you."
Waldo sighed. "Very well." He didn't need to offend the guildmaster, and the market would remain open until the horrible ball of fire set. Together, they headed to the guild hall. Chapter 19. Purple is a Pretty Color. Wilfon was a medieval merchant of Merchant House Arend. He'd spent 10 years focusing on the wool trade in Sagan, Lothport, Thobs, and Hyannis. Each spring he'd led a caravan of wagons up into the hill country for those four nations. He'd visit one little village after another, meeting with the shepherds, weighing and inspecting the freshly sheared wool, haggling over the price, and then moving on to the next tiny, miserable, fly speck of a village. Then, when every wagon was loaded down, he'd go to the city of Vermilha and try to squeeze out as much silver as he could from those damn thieving wool merchants. He would make a profit, never a very large profit, but a profit nonetheless. He'd spend the winter in Vermilha until it was time to set out and do the whole thing over again. Except the occasional bandit or goblin raid, it was all rather boring. So one winter he met with Lord Arend and got permission to sell his trade route, and instead go to Trezubon. He'd sold his villa and everything he owned to scrape up as much money as he could. He journeyed to Venezia, bought a small galley, hired a crew, contacted a Tarisian trader who promised to introduce him to the right people in the caliphate. He went to Trezubon, risking pirates, krakens, and storms. He arrived at the Golden Port surrounded by strangers dressed in bizarre sheets and turbans who spoke a barely comprehensible version of the human tongue that sounded like nothing but screeching to his civilized ears. The sun was always blazing. The food was so spicy it would burn a hole through your throat, and the dockside inns were filled with only three sorts of people: thieves, whores, and thieving whores. He spent 4 months trapped there, trying to find a silk merchant who would sell to him. His Tarisian trader, a dirty little monkey named Hafal, would go into the city promising one of his many contacts would come through. All he needed was a little more time, and just a little more silver to help things along. So Wilfon sat on the dock, suffering stomach pains, sweating through his clothes, listening to his crew's constant complaints, listening to Hafal's empty promises, and watching the coins in his purse slowly vanish. Every day brought him one step closer to ruin. Then one evening he got into a dice game with a caravan driver named Ahmed, who bet an introduction to his employer, a silk merchant named Kadri, against a gold ducat. Fortune finally showed some pity on him as his toss came up sixes. The next morning he met Kadri, a stunted little man who had to be at least a quarter dwarf. All the gold and silver he had left bought him 4 bolts of silk. That night he took Hafal drinking to celebrate his good fortune, then led the thieving little monkey to an alley where he cut his throat and got back just a little of the coin the man had stolen from him. Returning to Venezia, his galley very nearly sank in a storm. When he made it back, he sold the ship and used the money to pay off what he still owed the crew and book passage for himself and his 4 bolts of silk to Genesa. 1 bolt bought him a wagon, horses, and a place in a caravan bound for Torukai, where Merchant House Arend had trading rights. 3 months on the road and 2 bandit attacks later, he was here, standing in the house of black glass, as a drowned noblewoman was inspecting his silk. Wilfon knew that Lord Arend and most merchants avoided the drow. They had a bad reputation, and only the bravest or greediest traders would work with them. Wilfon didn't give a damn. He'd risked every copper he'd spent nearly half a year of his life traveling, suffered endless misery, committed murder, and nearly drowned. He was going to get the best price he could for his silks, and everyone agreed the drow always paid the most for luxuries. He licked his lips and wiped the sweat from his brow.
"Do my goods please you, lady?"
"I would like it better if some of this were purple."
"Blue, red, and gold are very popular colors,"
Wilfon assured her. She took some of the blue silk and pressed it to her cheek.
"It is wonderfully soft. Where does this come from?"
"A distant land called Wulan, at the far end of the world. It can be found nowhere else, and it's a secret what plant or animal is its source. It is most difficult to acquire, and most expensive."
She nodded and put the silk back down.
"I suppose I could have something nice made. How much?"
"How much would you offer for them, my lady?"
After all his hardships and expenses, he had a total of 12 silver and 82 copper coins left in his purse. When he'd sold his home and originally set out, he'd had 43 gold coins. If he couldn't get back more than that, then everything would have been a waste. The drowned noblewoman went over to a wooden cabinet and opened it. He could not see what was inside. She leaned in and took a moment, then shut the cabinet and came over to him.
"I offer you this."
In her palm were 2 glistening stones, each about as big as the tip of his pinky. Uncut diamonds. He plucked them from her hand and tried very hard not to reveal his excitement. He took a small lens he always carried with him and examined the stones. He was no jeweler, but every merchant worthy of the name knew the fundamentals about gems and precious metals. Both stones were a good, clear color with no obvious flaws. He would estimate each to be worth at least 30 gold coins.
"These are quite nice," he admitted, sounding bored. "However, I did bring you 3 bolts of silk. I don't believe this would be quite enough."
She rubbed a finger across her lips and considered.
"Oh, very well. They are pretty."
She returned to the cabinet and opened it again. She gave him a 3rd diamond of comparable size and quality.
"You drive a hard bargain."
"Fool,"
he thought, as she dropped the stones into his purse and bowed to her.
"We have an agreement, noble lady. The silks are yours."
"I'd like more," she said, "and bring me purple next time. I will pay double for purple. You can go now."
"Yes, my lady. I will see you again in a year's time."
As he was escorted out, he was already making plans to return to Venezia. He would get a much sturdier galley. Since he now knew Kadri, he could use that connection and not waste so much time sitting in port. He would also bring along a proper chef and a large supply of regular food. He was so busy with his thoughts he barely noticed a human girl in a leather jerkin passing him in the hall.
"Fool,"
Valeria laughed to herself as soon as the merchant was gone. In her cabinet was a large clay bowl with hundreds of diamonds, rubies, sapphires, and emeralds. Humans really did love shiny things. The door opened, and a human girl strolled in.
"Ah, Nandera, how did things go?"
Valeria waved a hand in her direction. The ruby on her finger glowed, and the illusion dropped away, returning the other woman to her true form.
"Badly," the drow blademaster said. "The ogre has no chance against Vaka."
"None?"
Valeria said in surprise. Nandera shook her head.
"Well, I suppose you would know. That's very disappointing."
"Well, there might be a way. I have an idea."
This visit to the guild hall was a little different from his initial one. This time, instead of being given just a peek into the library and then denied admittance, Lysnum led him straight down the hall and into the room. 10-foot-high bookcases lined the wall. Every shelf was covered with books. There were literally thousands. It couldn't equal the Corpse Lover family library, of course, but it was still a respectable collection. There were 4 long tables in the middle of the library. Lysnum led him to one of them. On it was a single, huge bar of gold and 5 stacks of books. Standing behind the table were 11 mages, all of them in crimson robes with some animal depicted in gold thread. Waldo realized this was the entire guild, except for Garibaldi. "What is this about?" Waldo asked cautiously. Lysdom walked around to the other side of the table so that he was standing with his guild.
"You keep saying you aren't acting on behalf of Avalon, that you are here completely on your own. If that's true, then we would like to reach an agreement with you."
Lysdom waved a hand at everything in front of him.
"That bar is worth exactly 10,000 gold marks. These books contain all the illusion spells my guild has in its inventory. If you really do have a talent in illusion, they'll help you master every sort of enchantment, including audial and full immersions. Some of those texts have useful spells from other schools, as well as potion recipes and seal formulas. Although these are the most useful books in our library, they're all yours. We'd only ask you to do one thing for us."
Waldo stared at the gold and the books. He could just imagine returning home with that massive bar as one of the spoils of his quest. His mother would be immensely pleased. It would be real, tangible proof of a successful first quest. Waldo wanted the book and the knowledge they contained even more. His talent in illusion wasn't anything worth bragging about, but he would at least be able to squeeze out all he could from it. Getting back all or most of the potions and seals he'd had would be useful, too. Maybe he could figure out exactly what he'd done wrong with the binding ritual and fix his contracts with Alice and Kronk. He wanted to bury his nose in those pages and devour them.
"And what would that be?" Waldo asked, his fingers already twitching.
"Go, and never return," Lysdom said. "Take your wife and your beast and leave. That's all we want from you."
"You mean now? Before the tournament?"
"Yes," Lysdom said with annoyance. "That is the whole point. Leave tonight, or at the latest tomorrow morning, and you can take all this with you."
"I wish you'd offered this to me when I first arrived."
"Well, we're offering it to you now. Will you accept it?"
Obviously, the wager on Bell was forgotten. The thought that taking a bribe and running away would damage his honor never even entered Waldo's mind. That it would hurt the reputation of the Whites was a bonus. The idea this would protect Bell and make Alice happy did occur to him, but those considerations weren't what mattered. Something that did interest him was how Valeria would likely react if he broke their agreement and fled. Drow didn't take that sort of thing well, especially not when it was done by someone they considered part of a lower race. He'd always hoped to work with some drow, and it would be a shame to ruin what would be a promising relationship, always assuming Valeria didn't plan to break her word and betray him.
"If I leave now, I think Valeria will want to kill me."
"So, you're a white mage. Given what you preach, she should want to kill you. That's to be expected. It's the two of you getting along that's bizarre."
That was true. One more burden of pretending to be a white. Despite the potential danger, Waldo seriously considered accepting Lysnam's offer. The gold and information were more than he would have hoped for before coming here. But there was a problem.
"Your offer is very tempting," Waldo said, "but I would need just one more thing from you."
"I'm listening," Lysnam said.
"Do you have any information about where I could find a dragon?"
"A dragon?" Lysnam sputtered. "There hasn't been a dragon sighting in this part of the world for hundreds of years. Why would we know anything about a dragon's lair?"
Waldo cast a longing glance at the books on the table, and then at all the shelves lining the walls. He gave a regretful shake of his head. It didn't matter how good Lysnam's offer was. Even if the man had been willing to trade him the contents of the entire library, it still wouldn't have been enough. Valeria was his only lead on finding a dragon. That information, even the possibility of that information, made anything else irrelevant.
"I'm afraid what you're offering me isn't enough, then. Sorry."
"So, you would have agreed if only we could tell you where to find a dragon."
Lysnam sounded angry.
"Well, what if I could offer you something just as good? I think I have the secret of true immortality somewhere."
He made a show of going through his pockets.
"Maybe I left them in my other robes."
"What about a gem of transmutation?"
Galen asked, looking furious.
"We have a few spare ones in the back storeroom."
"How about a djinn's lamp?"
a mage with the image of a bull moose demanded.
"Will you take a bag of infinity?"
Rodo asked with fury. Waldo stared at all the suddenly angry faces. If you have a dragon's egg, I'll leave Torikai within the hour.
Get out!
Bleisnam shrieked and pointed to the library door. Waldo frowned. There's no need to be rude. Just because you can't get what you want is no reason to yell. Good day. Waldo exited the library and the hall.
Can you believe the arrogance of the man? Galen said once Waldo was gone. To mock us like that, to our faces and in our own hall.
I've met a lot of arrogant wights before, Lysnam said with hands shaking and face red. But he surpasses them all.
There were nods from every other guild member.
It's easy to be arrogant when you have all the power of the Misty Isle backing you,
Kevin said.
So, what do we do now?
Verdi asked, twitching as he looked around.
I say we kill the haughty bastard, Galen said. That'll send a message to Avalon.
No, Lysnam said loudly. That might be exactly what they want, an excuse to come after us directly. You don't attack a white mage, ever. At least not unless you're absolutely sure you can escape suspicion. If anything happens to Waldo or Melissa while they are in Torikai, the guild or the crown will be blamed. We don't dare.
Then what are we supposed to do? Galen asked.
We just go back to the original plan. We knew there was little chance a white mage would be reasonable. We just kill his ogre, and that will solve everything. Waldo may take offense, but killing a white mage's servant is very different from killing a white mage. The guild quickly agreed with their leader. Melissa was in her room, having returned from lunch. She had planned to take Waldo out into the rat's nest again, so he could heal people. It would be a chance to spend time with him, and show Waldo the good he could do with his abilities. Unfortunately, he'd already left the palace before she could corner him. She was thinking about contacting some of her friends and asking them to look for Waldo when she heard a voice whisper in her ear.
Mistress Cornwall, will you come and talk to me?
She recognized the voice immediately.
Yes, I will come and talk to you.
Before her, the shadows melded together to form the face of Minister Barrows. Melissa's heart began to race. If the minister was contacting her directly, she could guess the reason. When he spoke, he confirmed her hopes.
Glorious news. Events have proceeded as we expected. Ask the queen for a formal audience and inform her.
Melissa listened and nodded her head eagerly. Chapter 20. News about home. The great market was interesting, though still disappointing in a way. In sheer variety of goods available for sale, Waldo would grudgingly admit that it outdid what you could find in Alter. There were expensive and exotic luxuries such as silk, ivory, scrimshaw, pearls, jade, feather cloaks, and polished corals. There were rare spices and foods like ground black pepper, nutmeg, cinnamon, cassia, bananas, coconuts, ground cocoa, sugar, lemons, and oranges. There were also live animals in cages available. Brightly plumed parrots and songbirds, monkeys, peacocks, flying snakes, and even a full-grown leopard. Goods from all over the world could be found here. The great market was certainly deserving of its reputation. At the same time, there were no magical items available for sale to the public. No spellbooks, no vials of enchanted potions, no scrolls, no magic rings, or anything else of the like. Even in the great market of Torikai, enchanted items were too precious for open sale. The only thing he purchased was some vellum that he might use for scrolls someday. He considered buying a peacock, they were pretty tasty, but decided the price was a bit too high. As spectacular as this place was, what he wanted was not available. Wandering past the many stalls, Waldo was regretting not being able to make a deal with Lysnam. It had been the right choice, but he could have done so much with those books. Just having a full inventory of potion recipes and seal formulas would make things so much easier for him. Unlike working most magical spells, Waldo was highly competent with making seals and brewing potions. That would go a long way in making up for his other shortcomings. Waldo suspected the dark powers were laughing at him again. It did seem a very cruel joke to offer him something he really wanted, but force him to reject it. If one of those books had chronicled the suspected locations of dragon lairs anywhere in the world, he, Alice, and Belle would already be on the road. Waldo was daydreaming about relearning the recipe for strength potion as a fellow mage approached him. He didn't notice until he felt someone grab his arm.
You're coming with me,
Melissa said, and began to drag him away.
Wait, what?
You're coming with me, Melissa repeated. Look, I don't have time to give away bread or heal a bunch of rashes and scabs, as much fun as that is. Maybe tomorrow. Right now I'm very busy. We're not helping the poor today. There's something else I need you for. She looked over her shoulder at him. There was absolute determination in her yellow eyes. You're going to help me with something important, and I won't let you refuse. I just need you to stand there and do exactly as I say. Hearing those words from Melissa, Waldo panicked, as he could guess what this was about.
Wait, wait! I'm a happily married man. I love my wife. I'm feeling tired. I have a headache. I'm a really selfish lover.
The people nearby turned to stare at him. Melissa looked furious.
Well, I am, Waldo said. I mean, I'm terrific at it, but just really selfish. Also, I hate to cuddle.
Waldo and Melissa were in the antechamber before the throne room waiting.
I still don't see why you need me for this, Waldo whined. I've already explained it to you, Melissa said, struggling to sound patient. I need to make an extremely important announcement to the Queen and her court. It would bring up questions if both the white mages in residence here weren't present. You've already caused far too many issues for the Order. All I need is for you to stand by my side and not say a word unless the Queen asks you something. And if she does, you need to agree with everything I say.
But you haven't even told me what this is about.
That's right, Melissa said. Because I don't trust you. I'm not interested in your opinion. This is a matter of real importance, and I don't need you causing another mess. All I want is for you to stand there, nod your head, and agree with me if the Queen or her advisor asks your opinion. Can you do that?
I suppose, Waldo said.
But I still don't think I need to be here for this.
She stifled a sharp retort. Melissa wanted to scream into his face for him to just do as she asked and be grateful she hadn't executed him. She'd always had a calm and rational personality. She'd dealt with her problems dispassionately, even when it involved fighting and killing. Melissa was never one to get over-emotional. She'd been devoted to the cause and always tried to behave like the ideal white mage. That was before she met Waldo and swallowed that thrice-cursed love potion. Since then, not a day had passed where she hadn't thought about him. Waldo's face filled her dreams at night and consumed her waking moments. He was her secret obsession, her shame, her everything. Occasionally when she prayed, she would stop and ask her god directly if he was testing her, if she had committed some grievous sin and was being punished. Melissa knew she'd done horrible things, but all of them had been in service to the Order. That meant they were fine, or they were supposed to be. Perhaps she'd been wrong, though. She pleaded with her god for some sign, but the one we follow never answered. Melissa had to rely on her own faith to decide what the right path was. When she returned to Avalon the day after Waldo drugged her, she could have told Minister Barrows the truth. One of the healers would have been summoned and purged the poison's effects from her body. She could have been cured. All this could have been avoided simply by admitting she'd been tricked. It would not have hurt her standing in the minister's eyes or in the Order. But if she'd done that, Waldo would have been hunted down. She couldn't let that happen. Had she made a mistake? Was all this the result of her own stupid refusal to ignore the feelings she had? No, it couldn't be so simple. It had to be that all this was the god's will, that everything had been for a greater purpose, that her decision was what the one we follow had wanted all along. Surely this was her fate, and not just the result of her own selfishness. The doors to the throne room opened. The herald sang out,
"The Most Honorable Mistress Melissa Cornwall, Ambassador of Avalon. The Most Honorable Master Waldo Rabbit of Avalon."
The herald took an audible breath and continued,
"Weep in gratitude, for you have been granted audience with Queen Madis the First, ruler of all Torikai, beloved of the gods and all men, the queen of youth and beauty, the guardian of the gate, the keeper of the scales, the fountain of wisdom and mercy, the lawgiver, the keeper of contracts, and the living embodiment of all that is beautiful to behold."
With the formality out of the way, Melissa approached the throne. Waldo matched her strides to remain right beside her. The audience included the 9 kings, nobles, and merchant lords who were all staying here as guests. And amid all these important people was the barmaid, the empty-headed, big-titted barmaid. The magical auras coming off Mattis, her throne, and every inch of the walls, floor, and ceilings made her skin crawl. She'd had long practice in hiding her discomfort. Next to her, Waldo scratched at his arm. Melissa came to a stop before the throne and curtsied. Waldo bowed.
"Thank you for granting us this audience, Your Majesty," Melissa said.
Sitting on her throne, Mattis gave a brief nod. Standing close by, Garibaldi was rigid and dour.
"We are most pleased to grant you this audience," Mattis said. "For what purpose did you request it?"
Melissa stood tall and held her chin up high. Her voice rang out through the throne room.
"Your Majesty, I bring you and your court news of the gravest importance. As of this moment, Avalon and the Alliance of Mist are at war with the wicked and corrupt forces of Ulteroth. We have proclaimed a sacred crusade and will not rest until their evil is purged from this earth."
The queen nodded, as if not taken by surprise. Garibaldi gave no reaction whatsoever. The kings and many in the audience turned and whispered to one another. The barmaid gasped. Waldo rounded on Melissa.
"What?"
His shout reverberated through the hall.
"You attacked Ulteroth?"
Melissa was startled by his vehement reaction. She was also painfully aware that the queen and everyone else were now staring at them in confusion.
"Did you not know of this, Master Abbot?"
the queen asked.
"No," he answered. "Not until right now."
"Of course he does the precise opposite of what I asked," Melissa thought furiously. "Your Majesty, as ambassador, I was the one contacted. I confess I was so excited, I neglected to tell my associate."
"We note he does not seem to share your excitement, Mistress Cornwall. Is there a reason for this, Master Rabbit?"
"I suppose I'm just stunned Avalon would attack Ulteroth like this without reason."
"Without reason?" Melissa gasped. "They are evil. They are wicked. They practice slavery and necromancy, and use monsters as servants. There are 100 reasons why they should be destroyed."
"Is that truer now than it was a year ago? Or 10, or 20, or 100? Why suddenly attack them now? Is Avalon really that hungry for war?" Melissa could feel her blood begin to boil.
"Are you defending Ulteroth?"
Waldo opened his mouth and paused a beat.
"No, of course not. But this is going to be the bloodiest war since the Shattering. Cities will burn and thousands will die. So I would like to know why Avalon started this."
"Actually," Garibaldi said, "I'm rather curious about that too."
Melissa already knew where Garibaldi and the guild stood. She'd hoped to embarrass him and the queen through the righteousness of her cause. Now, instead, she was on the defensive immediately after announcing the crusade. She'd had a stirring speech planned, but rather than enthralling everyone with it, she was forced to justify what did not need justification.
"We are defending ourselves. It was Ulteroth that chose war."
"Defending yourselves?" Waldo mocked.
"You're more than 3,000 miles away. How exactly were you attacked?"
"Ulteroth attacked one of our allies. We are honor-bound to defend them."
"All the countries in the Alliance are near Avalon."
Melissa shook her head.
"The nation of Dragal and their noble king Doran turned to us for protection. They are members of the Alliance now, and it is our sacred duty to defend them."
Waldo barked a laugh and put his head back.
"Defend them? Thanks to you, their entire country is going to be overrun, their city sacked, and their entire population enslaved. How is that defending them?"
"We will dispatch a mighty army to fight the Dark Mages and destroy them, no matter what it costs us in blood and treasure."
"How noble! And what will that help the idiot king or his people? By tricking Doran into joining your alliance, all you did was sign Dragal's death warrant."
"We did not start this war. Ulteroth did. They attacked our ally for absolutely no reason. What else can we do now but fight them?"
"No reason? Dragal is on Ulteroth's border. Your alliance wants to exterminate all dark magic and dark mages. It's not like that's any secret. The moment Dragal became your puppet, it turned into a dagger pointed at Ulteroth's heart. They had no choice but to conquer it."
"That's a lie. Dragol is a small, weak nation and no threat to the Dark Mages.
Then tell me something, Waldo asked. If a small, weak country near Avalon declared themselves allies of Alteroth and said they would welcome Dark Mages into their country, what would Avalon do?
Invade them and save them from their own madness, Melissa thought.
That would never happen.
Of course not, because they would get exactly what Dragol is going to get. Don't play the victim. You want war with Alteroth. What did you call it? A crusade?
Yes. You sound so very upset that this happened. You knew the moment Doran declared for you that this was inevitable. It's Avalon that chose war, not Alteroth.
Alteroth is evil and needs to be destroyed!
Melissa screamed at the top of her lungs. Waldo quickly stepped back from her. Melissa stopped and took a couple ragged breaths. She looked over at the Queen and Garibaldi. They were staring at her wide-eyed. She looked all around the throne room. Everyone was silent and staring, their eyes all accusing her.
Torikai did not want any part of this war. The guild wished to stay out of it and continue with business as usual. All the nearby countries would follow their example.
As the ambassador here, her job had been to try win the queen over to the right side, to convince her that supporting Avalon was the only choice and that destroying Alteroth would help her and her country in the long run. She knew it would be difficult to win Mattis over, but Melissa had hoped to shame her into doing the right thing. There would only be two sides in this war. Anyone who was not supporting Avalon was helping the Dark Mages. Getting Mattis to join the alliance was likely impossible, but if Torikai would give them financial assistance and supplies, that would be a huge benefit and make their logistics far simpler. At the absolute minimum, the alliance had to have the rite of passage through Torikai. All the roads in this part of the world intersected here. If they could not pass through, it would add hundreds of miles to an already too long march, and make their lines of communication vulnerable. Avalon had to have Torikai's support in this crusade. And now Mattis and the entire court were looking at her as if she'd gone mad. Melissa returned her attention to Waldo. He swallowed and took one more step back from her. She marched over to him and put her face right up to his.
"I'm beginning to wonder if you're worth saving after all," she whispered.
She turned on her heel and stormed out. Chapter 21 Raw Onions Are Tasty. Waldo watched her go and hoped his relief wasn't too obvious. For a moment there, he had thought she might attack him. He remembered all the stories he'd heard growing up about white mages and how fanatical and ruthless they were. If she'd had a knife in her hand, Waldo was sure she'd have stabbed him. He didn't want to think what would happen if the love potion wore off. He was lucky she no longer had a wand. Since he was no longer in immediate danger, he thought about the greater situation. Darius Heartless had been right. For years, his mother had complained during dinners about his shouts and rants over the possibility of Dragal joining the Alliance. His mother had always thought the notion ridiculous, since everyone knew it would trigger an immediate invasion. Alteroth was the most powerful country in the world, and Avalon its sworn enemy. Of course they would never tolerate an alliance puppet on their border. No one with half a brain would think otherwise. King Doran must have been manipulated by the Whites. There was no other explanation. Waldo did not doubt Alteroth would win. Each of the seven great houses had its own army backed with the destructive power of dozens of dark mages. If all seven came together, who could possibly defeat them? But a certain victory was still very different from an easy victory. His mother always said the white mages were skilled and the knights of Avalon were the best horsemen in the Shattered Lands, not to mention their war golems. Alteroth would triumph, but it would be costly. That Avalon would want such a war was just more proof they were all zealots.
"It seems the audience is at an end," Mattis said from her throne. "We are displeased that the ambassador would plead for this meeting, then be so disrespectful as to walk out without our leave."
"Your Majesty," Garibaldi spoke, "we still have one white mage present. Why not ask for his thoughts?"
The queen glanced over at Garibaldi, and then back at Waldo.
"Very well, Master Waldo. What is your opinion?"
"That all white mages are mad."
Mattis's eyebrows rose.
"Including yourself?"
"I'm wearing white robes, so obviously yes."
"And what do you believe we should do now that Avalon and the Alliance are at war with Alteroth?"
Let me answer that question with two of my own, Waldo said. First, how far are Avalon and the other Alliance countries from here?
About 3,000 miles.
And how far away is Alteroth? The Queen frowned.
Roughly 200?
Then unless you're eager for an invasion by the Dark Armies, I think the answer is clear. Waldo bowed to her.
With your permission, Majesty.
At the Queen's nod, Waldo left with Alice. The rest of the audience began to drift away. The Queen turned to her advisor and spoke with a faint voice.
What do you think?
Surprisingly, Garibaldi said quietly, I am in complete agreement with Master Rabbit. All white mages really are mad.
Asghar Faolan was a northman from Kajamin, the frozen and barren lands north of the Storm Sea. His people were barbarians who raided and pillaged the entire length of the Storm Coast. They were savages, big, brutish men who would arrive on their longboats out of a morning mist, sack and loot a village or town, and disappear back into the sea before the sun had reached its zenith. The hulls of their ships would be filled with women, children, horses, livestock, and whatever else they could steal. They were expert sailors and ferocious warriors. Asghar had been the captain of a longboat that suffered the very great misfortune of raiding a village when a company of knights were present. The knights cut down all but three of them. Asghar and two of his crew were put into chains and sold to a merchant house. There was always a demand for good fighters in Torikai, especially if they were exotic. And Northmen, with their flowing blonde locks, bushy mustaches, and tall, lanky frames, were always bizarre and interesting to the crowds. There was no slavery in Torikai, but there were also no prisons. Depending on the offense, criminals were penalized by fine, corporal punishment, banishment, a period of servitude, or execution. Debtors and their families were forced to work until their debts were paid. Those guilty of violent crimes usually received either execution or servitude in the pits. Asghar and his crew were Northmen, and so obviously guilty of murder, rape, and pillage. They were each sentenced to 20 years as gladiators, and would fight as many matches as they were told to. In theory, once they completed their 20 years, they would be free. But no one ever lasted that long. Every match was to the death, and most new gladiators, especially the debt servants, died in their debuts. About 1 in 30 lasted a year. Asghar had made it 6 so far. His crewmen were long gone, but the Northman captain was still here. The commoners and wagon drivers and shopkeepers who attended the pits loved him. He was easily the second most popular gladiator in the city, trailing only Varka. He only fought in the pits, of course. You didn't waste a popular entertainer like him in the arena, where he would be mowed down by the Minotaur. Lysnum sat back and looked the gladiator over. He was tall and muscular, standing 6.5 feet. His long blonde hair was wild and uncombed and went halfway down his back. His mustache was braided. Gray eyes stared back into his without effort. The man had a wolf skin draped over his shoulders and was bare-chested. 12 scars marked him. He looked every inch the savage. The rats and even many decent people loved it. Countless wealthy women paid good coin to spend an hour in his bed. Cavenet even argued that he should be retired as a gladiator and instead put to work in the pleasure house they had for female clients. Personally, Lysnum found the man about as appealing as a rabid wolf, but that didn't matter. Asghar bowed, proving that even a savage could learn manners given enough time.
How may I serve you, master?
Tell me, Northman, how would you like your freedom and a chance to return home?
Asghar's eyes narrowed.
The only freedom a gladiator ever gets is death.
Usually that's true, but there are always exceptions.
Nunc.
Lysnum used a negation to cancel out an invisibility spell. Lying on the table, a sword was revealed. It was a bastard sword, almost as long as Asghar was tall. There were runes etched into the steel blade, and the sword gave off a clear, golden aura. Lysnum heard the barbarian suck in a breath. He took 2 quick steps forward and reached out a hand before stopping himself. Asghar looked at him, pleading.
Go ahead. It's certainly not for me.
He snatched it up and held it in both hands. The gladiator stepped back from the table and put it through some practice swings. Lysnum could hear the blade whistle as it cut the air.
Magical weapons are very difficult to create. You mundanes have no idea just how rare they are. Most mages can't create permanent magical items other than wands or rods. Only mages with a talent in evocation can make genuine magical items.